If that relation held true in upstate New York, a big but not ridiculous assumption, arithmetic suggests that the four villages, packed closely together, were surrounded by between 8 and 16 square miles of maize fields. Between these fields was the forest, which Indians were subjecting to parallel changes. Sometime in the first millennium AD, the Indians who had burned undergrowth to facilitate grazing began systematically replanting large belts of woodland, transforming them into orchards for fruit and mast. The general name for hickory nuts, beech nuts, acorns, butternuts, hazelnuts, pecans, walnuts, and chestnuts. Chestnut was especially popular. Not the imported European chestnut roasted on Manhattan street corners in the fall, but the smaller, soft-shelled, deeply sweet Native American chestnut, now almost extinguished by chestnut blight. In colonial times, as many as one out of every four trees in between southeastern Canada and Georgia was a chestnut, the result, it would seem, of Indian burning and planting. Hickory was another favorite. Rambling through the southeast in the 1770s, the naturalist William Bartram observed Creek families storing 100 bushels of hickory nuts at a time. They pound them to pieces and then cast them into boiling water, which, after passing through fine strainers, preserves the most oily part of the liquid, to make a thick milk, as sweet and rich as fresh cream, an ingredient in most of their cookery, especially hominy and corn cakes. Years ago, a friend and I were served hickory milk in rural Georgia by an eccentric backwoods artist named St. Eom, who claimed Creek descent. Despite the unsanitary presentation, the milk was ambrosial, fragrantly nutty, delightfully heavy on the tongue, unlike anything I had encountered before. Within a few centuries, the Indians of the Eastern Forest reconfigured much of their landscape from a patchwork game park to a mix of farmland and orchards. Enough forest was left to allow for hunting, but agriculture was an increasing presence. The result was a new balance of nature. From today's perspective, the success of the transition is striking. It was so sweeping and ubiquitous that early European visitors marveled at the number of nut and fruit trees and the big clearings, with only a dim apprehension that the two might be due to the same human source. One reason that Bartram failed to understand the artificiality of what he saw was that the surgery was almost without scars. The new landscape functioned smoothly, with few of the overreaches that plagued English land management. Few of the overreaches, but not none. Cahokia was a glaring exception to the general pattern. A friend and I visited Cahokia in 2002. Woods, who lived nearby, kindly agreed to show us around. The site is now a state park with a small museum. From Monk's Mound, we walked halfway across the southern plaza and then stopped to look back. From the plaza, Woods pointed out, the priests at the summit could not be seen. There was smoke and noise and sacred activity constantly going on up there, but the peasants didn't know what they were doing. Nonetheless, average Cahokians understood the intent, to assure the city's continued support by celestial forces. And that justification fell apart with the floods, Woods said.